Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech language pathologist.
And I am Kate Hensler, a developmental interventionist with the First Steps program here in Louisville, Kentucky. How are you, Laura?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great.
I'm excited about our show today. Today's Thursday, October 8th, and we have a special guest. We have Jill Smith, Director of Southern Indiana's Autism Resource Center, joining us. Hi, Jill.
Hi.
Hi,
How
Jill.
Are you?
Good.
Well, we are so happy you could join us today to talk about what you do and the services that you offer parents. And one thing before, you know, we're specifically going to be talking about your center and the things in your area, but we want to make sure also that we give other parents an idea of very similar resources or how they can find out about places like yours, and again, really specific names of books and programs and different things that you recommend for parents who come to see you. So just if you're listening, if you're thinking, oh, darn, I'm not in Southern Indiana, this show is not relative to me, yes, it is. Keep listening because you're going to find resources that you can use, that you can seek out in your own city, and then books and all kinds of websites and other information. And Jill is always a wealth of information, and again, we're so happy you could join us today.
You're welcome. And I do work closely with many of the resource centers in Indiana and some in Kentucky as well, so I'll be happy to give out those resources as well.
Yay, that sounds great. All right, so Kate, do you want to just kind of start talking to Miss Jill, and I'm just going to kind of sit and listen today and join in? That'll be totally shocking for anyone who's listening.
Wait, let me
to our
show. No, I don't want to. Okay. Well, Jill, I don't know if anybody's officially said your title or what program you run, or so why don't you just kind of run us through that stuff just so we have a clue what it is, who you are and what you do and what you are in charge of these days.
Sure. I am the director for the Southern Indiana Autism Resource Center, and that's a big old title, but basically we run a library and resource room, and I help families get connected to the community. I spend a lot of time working with newly diagnosed families and getting them the resources they need and answering questions, because there's always a lot of questions, connecting them with books and DVDs and training programs throughout the state of Indiana. So that's mostly what I do.
Okay. And I was just wondering, for my own sense of knowledge, who funds you? I think I saw an email of yours recently where you have to come up with some of the funding yourself.
I do. I'm continually looking for grants and foundations that are willing to support our efforts in the community. Currently, I'm funded solely through the Horseshoe Foundation of Floyd County. Bridgepoint and Goodwill Services, as well as RALC, also support me as I work through both of those agencies in the community.
Okay.
Now, Jill, was this your brainchild? I mean, did you come up with this kind of idea on your own, or tell us how you how this center came to be? Because I bet there's some other moms thinking, I don't have anything like this in my community. So kind of tell us how your organization came to be.
Actually, a few community organizations got together and studied what was needed in the community. And then from that group, Goodwill, Bridgepoint, and RALC collaborated to write a grant to the Horseshoe Foundation. And that's how the Resource Center came to be.
What about the resource centers in other parts of Indiana? Are they kind of similarly organized, you know, usually just through a community effort?
Many of them are organized or through agency efforts. The one exception is the Indiana Resource Center on Autism, which is federally funded and does have many resources that I could borrow and use with the families that come here as well.
Is that the one in Bloomington?
Yes, that's the one in Bloomington.
Okay, I have heard of
that. Okay, so how do families find out about you, Jill?
Well, just shortly, my website will be up and running.
Yay!
Usually if they go through RALC's website or Bridgepoint's website, there's a link to get to me. And families are welcome to drop by at any time. I do only work 20 hours a week, but I'm more than happy if they give me a call to come in on the weekends or evenings, because I know the schedules are so hard to try and fit daytime hours into.
Right. And you work with families with children of all different ages. You know, usually our show, Kate and I, because we both do early intervention, it's mostly parents of toddlers and preschoolers. But you work with families with children all ages, correct?
I do, and I also work with adults in the community that have autism and Asperger's.
Wow.
Working on vocational rehab issues or some other living skills needs. But through Bridgepoint and Southern Indiana Rehab Hospital, we have an autism diagnostic team here, and that's where I get the majority of my early intervention children that come through, and I help those families get connected with resources in the community and what the next steps are, and of course that involves lots of training and education.
Right, and so tell us, like, if you had a mom coming to you today and she said, she's devastated, of course, and said, I don't know what to do. You know, my son is 2. We just found out he has autism. We don't know anything. I'm just brand new to this. What are some things that you would do, you know, kind of run us through a typical, although no situation is totally typical, but what you would recommend and what's kind of your starting point? And I want you to give us really specific resources and things that you would tell parents, like looking on websites or what books or what kinds of things that you found to be most helpful for families who are newly diagnosed.
Sure. I do give them an autism beginner starter kit, and it just has some basic information because autism can be so overwhelming. It touches on behaviors, how to help with communication, essential tips for caregivers and how to make your life a little easier, a little section on nutrition. I also give them a reading list, and each family is quite different. Some have researched a lot of information on the web before they come to see me. Other families are very new. Books that I recommend, 10 Things Every Child with Autism Wishes You Knew. That's a quick read, easy, clear, and very easy to understand. Early Intervention in Autism by James Ball, very good book, too.
Hold on a minute. Let's go a little bit slower. Back up and tell me the first one again, and let's talk about
who
the author is.
I'm not familiar with either of those. Are you, Laura?
I've heard of the 10 Things book, but I don't have that one.
Okay.
And that's one that I like to use with parents who are feeling a little bit overwhelmed with all the information that we tend to give them as soon as they get that diagnosis. And it goes through very simple things, including communication and behaviors and how to structure the home environment and create routines to make everyone's life a little more simpler. It's just a very quick read book that gives a lot of information.
Okay, 10 Things Every Child with Autism Wishes You Knew. Is that the name of it?
Yes.
Okay, and then who wrote that?
Actually, I don't have that right in front of me. I apologize.
Okay. That's okay. I'm just, you know what, and I have the list, the lending list that I think you emailed Kate or Kate got it somehow, and I see that on here. I'm good. Things we specifically talk about today, though, I'll be putting that on my website at teachmetotalk.com, and then I'll research who wrote that before we get that on there. Okay, so that was your first one. So that's kind of a basic starting point that you would recommend for parents as soon as they get the diagnosis. And what was the second book that you recommend?
Early Intervention in Autism. Some families want to know about different treatment types. They want to know what's most recommended, and not that I recommend any one therapy because I think it takes several to make it work. And each child is going to react differently to different strategies, but that's a good book to kind of get a background in what we do for early intervention for children with autism.
Okay, and tell us who wrote that. Did you say Dr. Ball?
Yeah, James Ball.
Okay. Now, these books, Jill, do you think these are readily available, like Amazon or bookstores and stuff?
On BarnesNobleUseBooks.com, wonderful way to get some good books without having to pay a lot of money.
Okay, good. All right,
well,
tell us.
Again, I'm going to pick your brain on that one, on the 10 things. No, early intervention and autism. Which, is there a slant from the, on the book's perspective of what the preference is for effective treatment, or is it really just kind of a...
I think it just basically lays it out and says that early intervention is key and just goes through different strategies.
Okay. Because I know that's something in dealing with families, a lot of parents who are, you know, they're into doing the research and everything, a lot of the research really kind of supports ABA, and that can be kind of even hard to get in this part of the country. So I just wondered if it...
And ABA is one of the only treatment modalities that's really been researched and has statistical support. But I encourage families to look at everything that's out there.
Right.
And so is ABA the primary proponent? Is he a big ABA proponent in that book? Early intervention.
I know there is a section on it, but no, I don't believe that there's any one modality that is supported through that book.
Okay. So it's just kind of a review. Or if it, or it just really talks about the importance of getting early treatment.
It does.
And I have to say, as a person in the trenches working with kids on the spectrum in early intervention, if ever there was a population that kind of legitimizes early intervention, boy, it is those kids on the spectrum, because sometimes we see them go from really, really affected at 2 to looking pretty darn good by 3. And so, you know, if there's any reason to say early intervention works, autistic kids, you know, they really keep us in business because they do typically respond very well.
Well, and, you know, the main reason for that, why I think that is because their little brains are so malleable at that point. You know, they tell us between birth to 3 is that greatest period of brain growth, and that whole concept of neuroplasticity, you really can change the way a child's, you know, total outcome can be just with lots and lots of very specific therapies and intervention early on. So that's why we believe so highly in this stuff. Jill, what would be next? What's another great early resource for parents?
Well, I've had a lot of parents check out The Way I See It, and that's written by Dr. Temple Grandin.
Mm-hmm.
And her books are always interesting to read. She is an adult with PhDs who touts herself as an recovered autistic person.
And so that's a great perspective. And I think the main reason people like her writing is they think, oh, my goodness, she was a kid with this diagnosis, and now look at her now. She's so successful and so articulate. And I think it gives parents lots of good hope, because I think when they hear the diagnosis, they automatically think, oh, no, my kid is never going to have a chance at having a great life.
Lots of parents think that. And still many of those parents are told that their child may never speak, their child may never be able to interact socially with their peers, and that information just doesn't hold true all the time.
People are, I'm always kind of saying the opposite, that, you know,
me too.
Prognosis is really much better, but that is kind of old school information about autism. You know, that's what, I don't know if it was more true or it was just said more readily, but I say they're the exception to the rule at this point, the kids I see. So even by 3, let alone as they get older. But I'm always saying it's not necessarily as bad as what you've read, as what you've seen on whatever website, you know. So.
What did you think this – oh, I'm sorry, Jill, go ahead.
There's another book that's similar to that. Dr. Stephen Shore worked on it, and he also holds PhDs and is on the spectrum. And I laughed when I saw it when it came out, because it's Autism for Dummies book.
Oh.
But reading it, it's really quite entertaining, and it has a lot of very valuable information in it.
That is great. Is that a newer book?
It is a newer book, and it looks just like those other books that you see.
Yeah. I mean, Internet for Dummies. I always think, oh, that fits me.
Yeah.
But I absolutely love Dr. Stephen Shore, and he just has a wonderful perspective on life, and just a great guy to listen to if you ever get the chance to see him at a conference.
Okay.
That is good. And I think that, too, autism is so serious when a parent gets that diagnosis, and sometimes to lighten it up a little bit and, you know, kind of take a step back, that it sounds like that might be a good book to help do that, too, for parents. And it not necessarily be a life-ending moment to get that diagnosis. I was going to ask, let's back up for a second and talk about the new research that came out this week that was all over the news. Now they think in the United States 1 in 91 children have been diagnosed with autism rather than our 1 in 150 before. Have you had people talk about that this week, Jill, in your circle?
I have, and I also am on the Indiana Interagency Autism Coordinating Council, and that's a hot topic right now for us. That's 1% of the population of children 3 to 17 now have an autism spectrum diagnosis.
And I so believe that statistic. I mean, there were so many people on the news that were saying, oh, we're not sure why that is. We think it's just because it's better diagnosis. We're not really sure. You know, it was parent reported, so we don't believe it's true. I absolutely believe that number, just based on the number of kids that I see, Kate, and the number of kids that you see, and just our little spheres of influence. We certainly feel like that's a pretty accurate representation, don't you, Jill? I mean, you didn't question that statistic, did you?
I didn't question it at all, because when I opened the center, they said, oh, we'll get a few families here and there. It's not, you know, a huge disorder. It's just a big need in our community. And I think after the first year, I had 160 families that had been through the center, all having children with that diagnosis. So
yeah,
that's a lot of families for this small little area.
Yeah, it really is. And it didn't, you know, and I think too, Kate, thinking about our caseloads, you know, in the past 10 years or so, and just the number of children that we have that aren't even officially diagnosed, but if we, you know, had to put a label on those kids, or when we talk about those kids and think about those kids, we think about them as being on the spectrum, even though they may not have that diagnosis yet. So I certainly believe that it's very prevalent. I always kind of chuckle, Kate, you know, that person that harasses me on the website from time to time and sends me those emails that say that I've made up autism just so that I can have a website. And I just, at first it really kind of, you know, took me by surprise. And then secondly, I just started to think how uneducated that is, that someone would think that that's not a very real and valid and permeating experience for lots and lots of families right now.
Right. Like you said, in the past 10 years is about how long I've been working with young kids in this capacity. And I think even in the 10 years, and I'll say up front that I'm probably more aware of, you know, suspicious behaviors, atypical things than I might have been 10 years ago. But even that aside, I'd still say I'm so much more aware of seeing kids who appear to be on the spectrum, some of whom do get a diagnosis before they're three, some of whom don't, but it just seems like it's getting worse. You know, it's more and more common. So.
Yeah, and what do you say when parents talk to you about things like that? I'm sure parents might not talk about that, Jill, but I bet you do a good bit of education in the community. Talk a little bit about how you address that when someone says, oh, this autism stuff, I think that's overblown and overdiagnosed.
Well, and the most comments I get are from special education instructors who say, I've been doing this job for 20 years. 20 years ago, this would have just been a learning disability, not classified as an autism spectrum disorder. And some of that may be true, but there is definitely an increase. I began working with people with autism in 1989, and I worked for an agency that solely dealt with children and adults with a diagnosis of autism. And it seemed like a pretty rare disorder back then, nothing like it is today.
Right. And so, but let me ask you then, when in 1989 and in the early 90s, do you think it was you were only working with children with what we would consider the severe aspects of the spectrum, you know,
yes.
Children who were, yeah, and then we didn't
children
really see.
Children who were minorly impaired were not being picked up on the autism radar.
Mm-hmm.
They were
right.
All classified as learning disabled.
Right. And so talk about kind of that transformation. What are the pros of having more children diagnosed and more? Talk about that.
Well, I think there are some very specific things we can do to help children, especially when we're looking at the sensory impairment aspect of the disorder, as well as being able to create routine and use pictures to facilitate communication, since we know social interactions and communications are always so difficult for these children. And even catching those kids that are minorly impaired, all those supports help them and make them more functional. And just increase their skills exponentially.
Right. What kinds of things, okay, so back to our discussion when we were saying if a parent came in and you rattled off those books for us, and if they say to you, Jill, you know, we're just not sure about all this therapy stuff. We're You know, what kinds of things, how can we get this stuff paid for? You know, take us through how you counsel a parent with that when they're coming in and saying, you know, I've been told my kid needs this amount of therapy, and just talk about kind of the best practices for that and how you suggest parents start to assemble their teams.
Sure. Usually we start with the school system to see what they can offer for the child. From there we go to other therapy places, maybe like Bridgepoint or RAUC or Southern Indiana Rehab Hospital or the other services that are available in Southern Indiana, to look at what that child needs, if they need additional speech, if they need occupational therapy to help address sensory and feeding issues. From that point on, we look at all the other support groups that are available in the area for families. Many families have very clear ideas about what kind of supports they want, what kind of groups they want to be involved in, and what kind of groups they don't want to be involved in.
Talk about some of that. I mean, talk about some groups, and but for parents who might not even know that these kinds of things are available in their communities, talk about some of the things that you know that you guys have and versus what you know are probably available in other cities as well.
Well, and just in our community, we do have a biomedical support group, and those are families that use a biomedical approach as well as some of the other approaches to help their sons and daughters diagnosed with autism. Some families are very firm believers in that type of treatment modality, and other families really want to look for some other perspectives. We have support.
Okay, and talk about, for a parent who might not even know what biomedical approach means, explain that.
Sure. There are some families, and I'll use some technical terms and try to explain them a little bit better, feel that their children may have toxic levels of metals in their systems. So they work with some supplements to try and detoxify their children. They also use other supplements that help increase the methylation process, which is that detoxifying the toxins that are in the liver. And they feel like that helps their children in the long run. And they just use a lot of medical supports along with regular treatments.
Okay, and so if a parent wanted information about that, what kinds of resources do you recommend for that?
I have DVDs in the library that are like Dr. Mark Greer. I have one of his lectures. Dr. Meyer, there's a few recognized doctors in the community, and those are all on DVD at the Resource Center. Plus, I have quite a few books, not just on biomedical, but also on just dietary aspects for children with autism. All in the
Jill, okay, I'm sorry, I want to butt in.
Go ahead.
Those doctors you talked about, are they literally in Southern Indiana, or?
No, I do have two that visit Southern Indiana. One is now located in Indianapolis, so he's rather close, and he's considered a DAN doctor, which is Defeat Autism Now.
Right.
And he helps support families who want those treatments. Many of the families still go to outlying areas as far as going to Florida, New York, where the other DAN groups are to get
right.
their treatments.
Now,
but
know,
there
I'm
is
sure.
a DAN.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Kate.
I was going to say, I'm sure you're familiar with Healing the New Childhood Epidemics book by Kenneth Bach, is it? Are you familiar with that one?
Only through reading book reviews. I haven't read the book myself.
I'm kind of muddling my way through it right now, but he is certainly of the biomedical persuasion. I wondered if that's the one I kept hearing about, so I bought it and I'm trying to read through it, but you don't have that one, huh?
I don't have that one. And Dr. Eugene Justice from Indianapolis has sent us a list that he felt was appropriate for families who wanted information on biomedical treatments. And so all those books are in our resource center. But we're always open. If you find a good book and you think other families would benefit from it, let us know and we'll get it in the library.
Well, I'll have to see which ones you have and get my hands on one of those and see. I haven't read too much of it. I don't know, you know, the whole biomedical thing to me. Again, the longer I work with this population, the more I don't feel like I'm an expert by any means, but it makes more and more sense to me that there is something to that. And I think if my child had autism at this point, that's something I would really not exclusively do, but I think I would spend time and effort and probably pursue that avenue as well.
I think I probably would, too.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I think I would, too. And I know that it's hard, especially with the dietary stuff. Jill, talk about that a little bit, what kind of information there are that parents find out there for finding out about that, or just kind of those, just give us some general ideas about that theory.
There are a couple of different key issues there. Families that do gluten-free and casein-free diets to lessen that inflammation within the gastrointestinal system. And then those families that do focus on the gastrointestinal issues for these children, either chronic constipation, chronic diarrhea, or just constant gut pain, that seems to go hand in hand with many children that have the diagnosis of autism.
It sure does. From what I see, it sure does.
Bloated little bellies, and their moms talk about they only eat two things, and they don't know if they're, again, they're constipated or they're going to have a blowout any minute. Yeah, I think those belly problems are pretty pretty consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And we do keep quite a few books on gastrointestinal disorders, and that's another area that where Dr. Justice likes to focus. When he sees the kids, he looks at them behaviorally. If they're flipped over the arm of the chair, you know, 90% of the time, he's asking mom and dad about their bowel movements, and do you think your son has or your daughter has, you know, an upset stomach most of the time? He says there are things that we don't normally pay attention to behaviorally that gives him a good idea of whether those kids are having gastrointestinal problems or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I so believe that just from spending an hour a week with so many of those kids, don't you, Kate?
Absolutely. It seems to be pretty universal in the kids I see. And sometimes parents are very aware of it and sometimes they're not. But if you ask a few probing questions, you know, they tend to say, seems like they kind of, I don't, this is my impression, that they kind of vacillate between they're constipated, oops, the blowout comes. You know, it's not pleasant, but they don't necessarily have the words to say, my belly hurts. Or, you know, that doesn't sound good because I can't digest it. But
and maybe they only focus on those few things that probably really aren't the best foods for them.
Yeah.
They process those foods, makes them feel good for a moment, and then their issues happen. So,
tell us some of those books that if a parent's listening to this right now thinking, oh, my goodness, that sounds like my kid. I didn't really even identify that as being part of his overall issue. What are some of those starter books you would recommend for gastrointestinal issues, Jill? Because I'm looking at your list, and I can't really see where those are listed.
I know. I was doing
Hope for Autism is one that...
Oh, I'm sorry. Say that again because I think you cut out.
Nourishing Hope for Autism.
Okay.
And then I have A Cooking to Heal, and that's a book as well as a DVD that talks about how to prepare these foods and what kinds of foods we need to be introducing to help with those gastrointestinal complaints.
Okay, Cooking to Heal. How would a parent find that? Where could they get that?
You could Google it or you can come into the resource library and check it out. We do 3 weeks at a time, and families like to come in and they ask me on the side, can I make a copy of this one recipe? I was like, sure, go ahead. I'll probably go.
Just don't tell me about it.
Okay, who did that? Who's the author of that, Cooking to Heal?
I know Julie Matthews does some of them, but it was in conjunction with somebody else, and I'm sorry, I don't have that information right at my fingertips.
Okay, and what about Nourishing Hopes for Autism? What? Was that right? Is that the title?
Yes. And that, again, Julie Matthews did part of that as well as another Dan doctor.
Okay. And is Julie Matthews a mom or is she a physician?
She's a dietary specialist, a registered dietitian who just happened to get very involved with what happens in the gastrointestinal problems with kids with autism.
Okay. What about websites to find that kind of information, Jill? Do you have any good websites that you recommend for parents?
Julie Matthews has an interactive website, and you just look, I think if you Google Julie Matthews, RN, it comes up, or maybe it's RD. I can't.
Okay.
But it's
okay, Julie Matthews, RD, okay.
Pretty well-known. Interactive website. You could post your questions, and she gets back on and answers them within a week's time.
Like yours, Laura. Cool. We like those.
It is like mine.
Real-life people respond. We like that.
And she lets you know if she's not going to be, you know, if she's out lectures, she'll post it on there and say it'll be an extra week before I answer your questions.
Now, on her website, Jill, does she have lots of information, just kind of articles and stuff too?
She does. She goes through all different kinds of diets and how to pinpoint what things are really bothering your child. And she talks about starting a diet. How long do you keep with those same few ingredients, and when do you move on? And just the wealth of information. She really does a great job.
Really,
so that would be a good resource for parents, even if they didn't feel like their physician was really on board with that. A parent could really take that information and kind of start to do some things on their own, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
Because even though this whole biomedical, you know, address the gut issues and maybe you'll make some progress in other areas is kind of, it's becoming more and more mainstream, but it's really still kind of on the outer periphery of general pediatric practice. Lots of pediatricians that parents may really think are wonderful, and they may be wonderful, but they don't really know that much about this, and they don't necessarily deal that much with nutrition, or certainly not the DAN protocol and all of that. So it is still kind of, I know there's lots of information on the internet, but it's not something that your pediatrician, who may be wonderful, knows too much about. And sometimes they kind of reduce it to, oh, that's crazy, you know. There's nothing wrong with his gut. And I think it's worth looking into. And if it means getting help outside of your pediatrician's office, then
any parent who has a child with severe allergies knows how to adjust a diet. And I think of it in terms of that.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking for the things that affect your child. My children's allergies will definitely affect their behavior. So we avoid certain things like the plague, and I think that's what the families that are using these techniques are doing as well. They find out what sets their child off, and they avoid it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so many of the kids on that I've seen who've been on the spectrum, they have the gut things. They frequently do have allergies to, you know, food things, to environmental things, and so often they have eczema. You know, there are lots of little things that seem to go hand in hand with all of that. But I'm just saying, if your doctor looks at you like you're crazy, keep looking for somebody who knows. And it sounds like that Matthew source is a very good one on the diet stuff.
I've just found on your list where you have all your diet books, it's Kate, if you're looking at that list, it's Speech, Language, and Diet and Other Therapies. Special Diets for Special Kids. I've heard people talk about that book as well. Jill, do you know about that one?
Yes, and it targets all children, not just children on the spectrum, but just special diets for every child and how to modify those diets and make sure they're all getting enough nutrition. Another book you might want to look at is the Autism and Gastrointestinal Complaints. That's specifically about those kids where you see the bloated bellies.
Okay, good. Who wrote that? Do you know?
It was a group of physicians, but no, I don't have that. I'm out of the library, by the way. So
I can't just run over there and
good, or
pull
be,
that out.
You'd
today.
Be running over there trying to find the authors really quick. But I'm sure all of these, I mean, these are fairly available. If you Googled them, you'd get to them, right, Jill?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, these are some, because I know I've had a number of parents whose kids have been diagnosed, and really oftentimes if they go this route, they're really kind of muddling through things themselves. They don't really have a source to go to, and, you know, your center or this information in bulk like this is great for them to have some way to proceed, because
it's not necessarily an easy road.
And there are a few periodicals that we get at the Resource Center as well. Autism File is one of them, and there's an autismfile.com that you can go to.
File, like F-I-L-E?
Yes.
Okay.
And Julie Matthews frequently has articles in there that are very helpful. But you can find a lot of support for biomedical treatments and some other alternative therapies that aren't as well published as things like ABA.
You know, in Autism File, you can find that magazine in, or, you know, it's kind of a cross between a magazine and a journal, don't you think, Jill? You can find that
like a journal, but have wonderful sections, but very easy to read information.
Yeah, and it's one that a parent might not necessarily know about because it's not everywhere, but you can find it in just regular bookstores if you really look.
Yes.
I've read that before. That's a good one. Okay, let's talk about emotional support for parents, because I think sometimes, even though autism is so prevalent, you know, hearing that diagnosis for a parent, they feel like they're the only one. You know, nobody else has ever felt like that. So talk about books or websites that you might recommend for parents that just from a parent's perspective would help them deal with hearing that diagnosis emotionally.
I do have quite a few books in the library that talk about some parenting issues, and I think once they get involved with the center or attend any of our educational classes, they realize that they're not alone and that there's quite a few parents out there willing to lend a helping hand. And depending on what they're dealing with, depends on where I help guide them for books and resources. We cover everything to minor behavioral problems, eating difficulties. I'm just trying to think of some of the things that the differences between autism and that Asperger's diagnosis, because there are things that will be done differently for both and things that will be the same for both.
Right. What kinds of books have parents told you that they really, really, what do your parents rave about? But you get consistently good reports on, just from a parent's perspective.
And it depends on what they're looking for. A lot of them like the Autism Heroes tabletop book, just to come in and see all these wonderful kids and read little stories about what they've done. Some of them like the DVDs. We have one that's called Paper Words or The Power of Words, and those are both very inspirational DVDs that families can check out. A lot of them like the children's books, because sometimes it's harder to explain to the other children in the family what's happening and what this diagnosis means. And we have some books that help explain that.
What are your favorite children's books that explain that? Which ones do you like the best?
It is Izzy Cover Her Ears. It's just so cute and so fun for the kids. It kind of gives them, oh, yeah, I've seen my friend do that. I didn't know why, and that book kind of explains what's going on with sensory impairment. We have other books that are fun for kids with the diagnosis of autism to have read to them, like What's That Look on Your Face? And it goes through all these different faces, because that's a skill that's very hard for children with autism to understand. So it works very well.
And are those books readily available, Jill, like in a regular bookstore? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have those, Kate. I might take a look at some of those. I don't have any of those.
I don't either.
And the AAPC books, I don't know if you've been to their site before. They have a lot of good children's books as well that are great for classrooms or daycares.
Okay, tell us that again.
It's Autism Asperger's Publishing Company.
AAPC, okay. And that's .com?
Yes.
Okay. And so good books.
And I may be pulling you off topic, Jill, but I'm looking here at one that piques my interest, Learning with a Visual Brain in an Auditory World.
An awesome book. And I use that with someone who's developing a residential treatment center, and we kind of went through it because she was very new to autism. Definitely how to flip things and think of things in a visual manner. When we're so used to just communicating verbally, how do you support that person on the spectrum and flipping the way you view everything to help support people with autism?
Okay, would that be even for parents of, like, younger kids, Jill, or is that mostly an older kid thing?
No, I think it would work for younger kids. I'll tell you now, it's a rather lengthy book, but it has very specifics on how to use picture schedules, how to support people and grow those picture schedules as they grow, and gives you the importance of never taking those things away. Even if you finally graduate to using a day planner, not to take that away, because when stresses go higher, people still need those supports no matter how recovered you think they are.
And so that would be a great book for therapists too, don't you think? Because we have lots of therapists who listen to this show every week. Kate and I got a really cute email from a lady today who said that, or not today, but this week. She was so cute. Kate, how did she say it? She's retired, so she doesn't get contact with her professional friends anymore.
Yeah.
And so she listens to Kate and me to kind of get that outlet every week, which I think is a hoot. But that would be a good book for therapists to kind of look at and think about, just therapists who treat kids on a continuum then.
It is.
And who wrote that, do you know?
No.
I should have sent you that little list to say, oh, and by the way, I'm going to ask for the author of every
book. Author of every book.
I can get those all to you. I just don't have access.
That's okay. It's no big deal.
As long as they're mainstream books. I mean, I frequently Google books that I only know the title. Sometimes I only know a couple words of the title. And,
sure.
you can search through it a little bit, you can.
And if anybody needs more information on the books, they could email me. That's fine, and I'll get that right back out to them to make it easier for them to find the book.
Okay, give us your email.
It's jsmith at rauchinc.org.
Okay, I'm going to put that on the website too, my website, so that
they're trying to find one of the books that I talked about, and I'll get that information out to them.
That sounds good. Talk about social stories, Jill, and how parents can use social stories. And I think you've got a resource listed on here for that as well.
Sure, I have plenty of resources, actually. I have Carol Gray's book, The Social Stories and How to Create Social Stories, and an interactive DVD that parents can come in and use to learn how to write those social stories to help their kids get new skills in difficult moments. And I said the whole key to doing that when I talk with parents is starting not when you're at the most challenging moment, but starting ahead of time and explaining why it is that, you know, we wash our hair every night in the shower, or why it is that we maybe can't get everything we want at the moment we ask for it.
So go back to the beginning and explain social stories. Like if a mom came in and she said, I'm having these three behavioral problems, and you were going to introduce the concept of social stories to her, start, you know, talk to our audience like you would a mom about that, and talk about what a social story is and why we use it and why it's effective.
Sometimes social stories are just what we would expect every other child to know. Maybe you have a child that's getting ready for preschool. To do a social story, we're going to let them know about preschool and how what's expected at preschool in a non-confrontational way by just telling a story and talking about the situation and what's expected. Maybe we first work on when we enter the preschool. We talk about this friend that goes to preschool and they hang up their backpack and they hang up their coat and then they sit in the circle and wait for circle time. And you talk about all the positive things, and that's just kind of shaping and preparing that child's mind for the transition that's about to happen or about the behavior that we hope to see in the future.
And so do you recommend that parents take their pictures and make a little book? Because that's how I use social stories with my little clients that I see, is we actually make a short little book and we follow Carol Gray's guidelines. And it's very short and, like you said, very positive, and it states exactly what we would want a child to learn how to do. And we might just take little digital pictures and plot those on a sheet of printer paper, and then write a little sentence under that. And again, it's pretty short, but it kind of takes them through whatever situation and explains how, ideally, we want that situation to unfold.
Ideally, yes. That's a good
yeah.
And, yes, I always use pictures, and especially when we're talking about, and even with older children, when we were transitioning children from elementary school to middle school, we took pictures and new teachers, a locker, all those things that change when you go from elementary school to middle school. And the same thing works with younger children, just some kind of concrete idea of what the change is going to be.
You know, and you talked about this earlier, so many children that are on the spectrum really do process information that they see much better than things that we tell them and things that they hear. So if they have the picture to kind of go along with the your very simplified explanation, I do think it makes something that's so abstract become a lot more concrete, especially to our little guys, the little ones that we're seeing. You know, I haven't written an article about social stories for the website, Kate, but we need to do a show on that and talk about that and how to use that and how parents can incorporate that in information for therapists, too. I don't know if you use a lot of social stories, Kate, and I haven't done it in a long time, but, boy, that's an effective tool.
I have not with kids on the spectrum. I've done similar things with other kids that were more kind of language-focused, but not necessarily.
Right.
I know the theory behind them, but haven't really used them much at all with kids on the spectrum because our kids are out of our hands at three, so I think usually that comes. Schools usually do a pretty nice job of that, or some schools do, some teachers or therapists who work through the school system, but I personally have not done a great job of that in practice, really.
But like Jill just brought up, you know, if you have a kid who doesn't want to wash his hair every night, you know, of course
mm-hmm.
you're not going to go into a big explanation with a two-year-old about, you know, your friends don't want to see you with dirty, yucky hair, whatever you would, you know, with an adolescent. But certainly you can make that useful even on a really basic level for lots of kids. And I think
right.
just having that kind of expectation or script, for lack of a better word, for those kids makes a lot of those daily routines easier, and especially for those kids with sensory processing challenges that they – you know, you have to be able to wash your hair. You have to be able to get through those things. So I think social stories are a great way to work on that. And it's something that a mom feels like she can actually do rather than just hoping and praying that it's going to get better.
Right. It won't be the nightmare it was last night.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think I'm going to run over and see you and borrow your Carol Gray stuff, Jill. So we,
let me know
because so
I want to get some
that.
Of the biomedical stuff. I was interested.
Yeah, we'll have to make a little field trip to the
DVD
at Autism Resource Center next week, won't we?
Jill, is there a similar thing in Louisville? Because I'm not aware of it.
A similar resource center?
Mm-hmm.
I know, and I haven't been to all of them. Home of the Innocents does a good job of providing some therapies in the community as far as ABA, although I understand there is quite a waiting list right now.
Mm-hmm. I think so, the last time I heard.
And there will be an Autism Info and Resource Fair this Sunday, October 11th, from 5:30 to 7:30 at the University of Louisville Rock Planetarium.
Hmm.
And that's
wow.
going to several different agencies that provide services for children and adults with a diagnosis of autism. So that may be a good place for families that are on the Louisville side to go and get some information.
5:30 to 7:30 at the Planetarium at U of L.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
That is interesting. I didn't know
that.
About that.
Okay, I'm going to slow you down or back you up, Jill, because we kind of came into this whole discussion a little bit backwards with starting with the biomedical, and then because we have not really asked you specifically the number one thing that I hear parents say, you know, most consistently is whether the child's on the spectrum or not, but certainly with kids who are on the spectrum, they're concerned about their child's ability to communicate. They want them to talk. They want them to be able to let them know what they want, when they want it. And certainly we see in practice that when kids do begin to communicate, oftentimes the behavior improves because they're not so frustrated. And so, we, you know, it's very important to most parents, and we have not really said, so when that mom comes in, and Laura, as a speech therapist, you certainly know that that is a primary focus and concern
oh, yeah.
of most parents. So if, say, that mom walks in and says, you know, my child was just diagnosed, and he's getting speech, but we, you know, we're not really sure about what we're doing on communication, or we'd like additional information related to communication. Where would you point that family?
Sure. Depending on where they're at with communication, whether verbal or nonverbal, families can come in and use...
Well, let's say they're nonverbal. Child's 2.5. He's been in therapy 6 months, but he's not talking, hasn't made a lot of progress. Where are you going to send her?
We're going to look at where the biggest meltdowns are. Then we might, especially if it involves hunger, that's usually one of the biggest ones. Kids really need help communicating that. So maybe we focus on making a choice board with pictures from their favorite snacks. Maybe it's animal crackers and Cheez-Its, and we just cut the label off.
Let's hope they're not on the diet, because those are
good. Yeah, let's hope they're not. Usually those are the favorite things. And tell mom and dad, you post that right on the front of your refrigerator when he starts screaming and yelling, you're pretty sure it's hunger. Let's get on over to that board and let them make a choice for their snack. And we have a lot of books and DVDs that families can use to find pictures if they don't want to take pictures themselves or bring in wrappers. And those things are readily available for the families there. They could do the make it and take it choice boards or a sequence schedule. If there's a certain part of the day where they really just need a little bit of help, maybe it's right after school for the older kids. For younger kids, it may be up to bedtime where we have that thing, the routine that we develop, and then we finally get to the turn out the light, and that's that, and hopefully that helps them get that communication down with their child. Lots of different resources, books, Communication Unbound covers many different modalities of communication. We do have some books on augmentative communication where, you know, they talk about using touch talkers and how to make those effective. And keeping those effective so they don't turn into games for the children.
Mm-hmm.
Text. We also have baby signing times, DVDs, and the regular signing time series that families can check out for 3 weeks at a time. And sometimes children come back and want the same DVD over and over again, and that's okay too.
Yeah, I could see that. How about, I think this is one I'm familiar with, It Takes Two to Talk.
Yes, that's in the library as well, and that sometimes you have to wait to get it because I have 2 copies and they're usually almost always in circulation.
That's a great book. Kate, do you have that book?
I think I do.
I think you have it too. It's one of those Hanen books. And it's green and it's little and it's an easy read, and it talks about reading your child's cues and just how to really observe and wait and listen, and again, kind of realize that it's not just about your kid talking, it's about you reading your child's signals and setting up the situation so that he can learn to interact and communicate.
Okay.
I'll loan that to you if you can't find it.
Okay. Through your list, Jill.
I am too. I'm kind of looking at that. You don't have More Than Words on here, and I think that's the greatest book ever written for parents of children that are on the spectrum with language delays. That's a big, thick book. Jill, do you have that, More Than Words?
On a book order right now, so.
It's hard to get. It's like
80
bucks
now. For a while
you
couldn't get it at all, and then it's back. It is expensive, but.
Yeah. Yeah, it was quite expensive, but that's okay. I've heard it's a good book, and I need to have
it. It's a great book.
Uh-huh.
It's a great book. I like that a lot. Kate, do you still have that one?
I believe I have your copy of that one, actually.
I was going to say, I don't want to be trading to get that one back.
No, I haven't seen it. I don't know what happened to it. Yeah, I think I do still have it.
And I have another one of yours that's so relevant to what we're talking about today. It's the Affect Based Language Curriculum. Do you know that one, Jill? It's written by the speech pathologist who's a partner with Stanley Greenspan, and it really takes very specific, focused language goals, and it's very black and white about how to work toward those language targets, either at home or in a classroom situation. It's a good one, too, but it's more geared toward therapists than parents, but it's still a great book. That might be something that you would want to take a look at, too. Do you have therapists that come over and borrow your books, Jill?
I have a lot of First Steps therapists that come in and borrow books and DVDs and use them with the families or come in and make copies of some article. Maybe it's something that I published in the newsletter and they want more information on it. So I do get quite a few therapists and people from the school system that come in for information.
Okay, now tell us, you said you're going to have a website up and running. Did you give us that address yet?
Well, as soon as I get it.
Oh, you don't have your site address yet?
We're meeting on Tuesday to get that all settled, so as soon as I get it, I will forward it on to you.
Oh, that sounds great. That sounds good. Kate, what other, in wrap-up, what else do you want to ask Jill that we didn't get a chance? An hour flies by.
I know.
We will be having Dr. Harry Schneider from Columbia University coming on November 20th for our third annual Autism Summit. And you could look him up on the autismfile.com as well, and he's done a lot of language development research, and not just in young children, but in older children too, and some of the techniques he uses to increase communication in all children on the spectrum.
Cool. Now that's November 20th. It's in Southern Indiana, and Dr. Harry Schneider.
Yes.
Is that what you said? And how can parents find out more information about that conference?
Email me directly. The flyer will be going out next Wednesday.
Okay. And give us your email one more time.
jsmith@raukinc.org.
Okay, and I'm going to put that on my website at Teach Me to Talk, too.
And Laura, Jill, what's the nature of his presentation? I mean, is it a two-hour thing? Is it an all-day thing? Is it?
He'll be speaking from 1 to 4. He's very personable and energetic, so no telling where his talk may go. But he is to be talking about his research and language development, and he's pretty dedicated to that research, so I'm pretty sure he'll stay on topic, but I can't guarantee it.
We like people like that.
Yes, obviously. We can.
And
relate.
Where is that gonna? Yeah, where's that gonna be, Jill?
That will be in the Sheridan in Jeffersonville, down on the river.
Fun.
All right. Can you think of anything?
Well, I just want to tell our listeners that I'm going to put all these things that we specifically talked about on my website at teachmetotalk.com, and I'm going to after I make this list, I'm going to pare down Jill's big lending list of the things we kind of talked about today, and then Kate will add our tried and true things that we like on there as well, specifically that we've talked about in the past, as kind of our new little resource article for parents of children newly diagnosed with autism, and then we'll let Jill take a look at that and kind of add and subtract. But that should be on the website in the next week or two, so look for that on there. You can email Jill, and I'll have her email information on the website. And then, Jill, if anybody contacted you from another part of the country, you're probably connected well enough so that you could help parents, you could point them in the right direction where they could find resources in their own communities, right?
I can, and I do that usually through the Arc of Indiana. I don't know if you're familiar with that, and families can go to that website.
That's your other hat, isn't it, Jill?
It is. It's my other hat, but we're connected nationally,
okay.
So it makes it easier for me to connect with other resources in other states. If they want to look at our website, it's www.arcind.org. Lots of good family resources up on that website.
Okay, that sounds great. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. I am going to run see you for sure so that you can have my DVDs in your lending, whatever it's called, library there for parents. And I haven't seen you in a long time, so it'll be real fun to pop over and visit. Kate and I'll have to do that, take a field trip to Southern Indiana.
Oh, that'll be fine.
That sounds good to me, and I'm going to borrow some things.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thanks so much, Jill.
Thanks
really
so
appreciate it.
Thanks so much for joining us, Jill.
All right,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, and next week we're hoping to have another guest on, but that's not confirmed. I guess you'll just have to listen in and have that as a surprise. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to have Dr. Amy Garlove back on, who was a pediatrician that was on this summer. And this time she'll be talking about specifically how to talk to your pediatrician about developmental delays. I think that's going to be a fabulous show because she's so approachable and so great, and she had a parent with a child with developmental delays, so she understands from both ends, the mommy end and the physician end, so I think that's going to be a great show. And then we have another great guest who is a curriculum director at a school here in Louisville for children with learning differences and learning difficulties. So I think she's going to be a wealth of information for parents too. So we have lots of great guests coming up in the next month.
And we love guests because it gives us, you know, Laura, the other day at the meeting that on that child that we share, oh, the service coordinator and the mom kind of asked a question, and I was really only able to respond, and I think I did correctly because of our physical therapist friend who had been on many, many, many months ago when she, you know, when Michelle Wilder came on and talked about
right.
tone and gross motor development, and I was like, I know this because Michelle, this is my learning opportunity. So, I mean, all, a lot of those things that Jill talked about, I really wasn't familiar with. I mean, I think I know about the most kind of widely read, widely recommended things, but maybe I'm not even up on that, but certainly I'm not up on all of the, you know, the great wealth of information. And having guests on gives us a chance to pick their brains and learn what they know. So,
right, and just help point parents in the right direction. And I always tell parents, it doesn't really matter if I know exactly what you're asking me. It just matters that I can help you find the answer to that question. So we don't have to be the expert on that. We just have to help parents figure out where they can go to get those real answers. So we hope that that's what we do every week on the show. And it was so nice to get that sweet little note from Mary Gallagher this week. Thanks, Mary. You made our day with that
little
email.
If she's listening, she needs to call us. We want to hear what she's doing in the trenches. So she needs to call us.
We would love it. We would love to have any of our parents that regularly listen, and certainly therapists would love that. So call us, even on days that we have guests. We'd still love to hear from you. Okay, that's all for today. Join us next week. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye.